Hi, everybody. It's Brian Greene from the Commercial Break Podcast. It's likely you've heard of the show if you're directly related to me or you follow our MySpace page. But I'm not here to talk to those three listeners. I'm here to appeal to people who haven't heard the show. Along with my co-host, Kristen Joy Hoadley, we're taking a deeper look at the topics that are affecting our youth today. Like, who are the people who are dating ghosts? Where did all these pickup artists come from? And why doesn't my preacher have a nicer private jet? We understand that these are the issues you really want to get to the bottom of. The Commercial Break is now available on the Odyssey app or wherever you find your podcasts.
I am pretty sure that I've gone through an airport that had the facial recognition where you scan your ID and then you look at a camera and they confirm it's you. And there's such a process, and going, traveling, flying, going through the airport is so stressful anyway that I'm pretty sure I didn't ask any questions. I think I just walked and went wherever they told me to go. Well, apparently, this facial recognition pilot program from the TSA is expanding across the country, and it's more invasive and dangerous than you might think. Joining us now is Jeremy D. Scott. He's the director of Epic's Project on Surveillance Oversight, and he has looked in depth at TSA's implementation of facial recognition. Jeremy, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I think, I'm pretty sure I did this. I was going on an international flight. I think it was here. And you know how you're stressed when you go through the airport and you just look where TSA tells you to look and hand them their passport or what have you. Explain to us what this pilot program exactly is, this facial recognition program.
So you had that right. So the TSA at security checkpoints uses facial recognition. It's a one-to-one, meaning that they use your picture on your ID to compare it to a live picture of you right there when you're at the security checkpoint to see if those two things match. And as you kind of indicated, a lot of people don't realize you can opt out. You know, the security lines are stressful situations. Sometimes there's signs, sometimes there aren't signs, but they're small. You usually don't notice them. And when you actually come up to the security officer on the little screen there, in my experience, it says follow officer instructions. And never has the TSA officer once ever said, you know what, you can opt out of this if you want.
So why is it more dangerous than we really think it might be? I think a lot of people are uncomfortable with the idea of facial recognition. I know stadiums, for example, will use it in, like if they've kept somebody out of the, they've done, a person has done something wrong, and then they decide to ban that person, that they will use facial recognition to make sure they never come in again. So it's kind of out there. But why is it dangerous?
Yeah, I mean, the reason it's dangerous and why I described it as something that might be dangerous than you might think is, I mean, first of all, it has to deal with the fact that we don't have any kind of overarching regulation of facial recognition. And so if you take TSA's implementation, for example, right now it's not the worst implementation. Using one-to-one is better than using one-to-N, and one-to-N is comparing your face to a database of images the government has. TSA does have a separate program like that, but it is opt-in. It's a part of the kind of like, pre-check program, for instance. So you would actually have to sign up for that purposely. But for this implementation, you know, what's happening here is, one, you're building the infrastructure for facial recognition. All right. You're also normalizing your face as an ID, right? And when you do those two things, especially when the federal government does it and they're doing it on millions of people, it kind of normalizes it and it helps it expand. And when you're doing that in the context of no regulations, right, it puts us as a society in a position where that can easily be expanded and abused and used in ways that are extremely problematic for our privacy, for our civil liberties, for our democracy. So that's why I say it's more dangerous than you might think. Is partly, in large part, because we're doing this without really thinking about the consequences. We're all thinking about what are the safeguards we need in place and when should we use it versus when we shouldn't use it. Those things we haven't really done, but we're moving forward. And when the government does it, everyone else kind of follows suit, and it can expand in ways that are problematic without proper you know, thought about how we should actually use this.
Yeah, and you mentioned that a lot of undemocratic societies are already using, the governments are already using facial recognition, using and abusing it. You mentioned how even here in the U.S., unregulated facial recognition systems, getting used to that could lead to civil rights abuses and so forth. Can you explain maybe just what are some very specific abuses that you've seen or that you fear might happen?
Yeah, I mean, there's been instances where people participating in, you know, First Amendment protected speech and protests have been identified via facial recognition. Obviously, that has a chilling effect even if you're doing something that is protected under the First Amendment, law enforcement can use facial recognition to identify you. Additionally, you know, we've seen a number of people in this country who have been wrongly identified as a perpetrator to a crime and then arrested and thrown in jail before they were, you know, absolved. And it was, you know, law enforcement realized facial recognition identified the wrong person. Part of that is because we don't have the type of regulation that says, you know what, you know, either saying you can't use this, which I think would be ideal in order to, with respect to law enforcement's use, in order to protect us against the abuses. But we don't even have something saying that if you're going to use it, this is how you can use it. These are the proper safeguards that need to be in place to avoid the situation where you have a completely innocent person's life uprooted because the police show up at their door, arrest them, you know, a lot of times in front of their family and take them off to jail when they hadn't done anything wrong.
Jeremy Scott, director of EPIC's project on surveillance oversight. So how unreliable are these systems? And I'm assuming that in each place they're different. Some technology is probably better than others. So generally speaking, are they unreliable?
Well, I mean, they vary. I mean, obviously, it's gotten better over the years, but there's still kind of issues with bias. They can work, you know, not as well on certain demographics, so women or people with darker skin, sometimes older people. It can be dependent on the particular facial recognition algorithm itself in terms of, like, where the issues are in terms of the demographics it has more trouble with. But a lot of times, you know, those things we don't know. We don't have kind of the transparency necessary for people to understand how well these work and to make sure that there's kind of independent auditing to ensure that they are working, you know, as well as we would expect them to work.
Yeah, I actually first heard of the ability to opt out through a Travel and Leisure magazine article. Someone mm-hmm. saying, yeah, you can opt out of it. So practically speaking, I like hate causing a scene and I hate conflict and I'm so afraid of like ruining my vacation, even doing something that I'm legally allowed to do. So how do I opt out and what can I expect if I say, hey, I don't want to do this?
Yeah, so you know, you just tell the TSA officer right when you walk up there that you would like to opt out of facial recognition. And, you know, what they do at that point, they're either going to check your ID, you know, hold it, look at it, look at you. Or sometimes they still put it in the machine, but they don't run the camera. And, you know, they're looking at the image and looking at you. Sometimes what I'd like to say when I go up there, because, you know, facial recognition can be used to replace some of these TSA officers if the facial recognition is an identity verification. You tell them, you know, I'm going to opt out because I'm trying to protect your job. To make sure that this machine doesn't, cancel the jobs at TSA and, you know, to lighten the situation a little bit.
Yeah.
Hi, everybody. It's Brian Greene from the Commercial Break Podcast. It's likely you've heard of the show if you're directly related to me or you follow our MySpace page. But I'm not here to talk to those three listeners. I'm here to appeal to people who haven't heard the show. Along with my co-host, Kristen Joy Hoadley, we're taking a deeper look at the topics that are affecting our youth today. Like, who are the people who are dating ghosts? Where did all these pickup artists come from? And why doesn't my preacher have a nicer private jet? We understand that these are the issues you really want to get to the bottom of. The Commercial Break is now available on the Odyssey app or wherever you find your podcast.
A quick question, too, on when it comes to facial recognition. Is the TSA facial recognition the same idea as Clear, where they scan your eyeball, and do you consider them equally dangerous? Do you not like Clear either?
Yeah, I mean, they're both problematic, partly because of the lack of regulations. The TSA's one for kind of like the general security is one-to-one. I think Clear probably uses a database, and I don't know for sure, but I'm pretty sure they do. Using a database is more problematic because you're actually collecting people's biometrics. That means it can be subject to, you know, a breach. That means it can be used, you know, down the road for things you might not approve of. It's obviously a better implementation to have one-to-one where, you know, you have your ID, they take a picture, they compare it, and then that data is kind of gone. The government or the company's not holding it and then can use it in ways down the road that might be objectionable.
Is there anything problematic about those concessions, like the Amazon Go store? I don't know if they still exist or not, but where you go in, they know who you are, they know what you've picked out, and then you just walk out. You don't stop at a counter and pay for it. It goes right to your credit card. Are those problematic at all?
When they're verifying your identity via biometrics.
I know it's not exactly the same thing, but it's like the Amazon Go stores where you have an Amazon account, for example, and you go in. I think you scan your phone when you go in. They watch you. They track you while you're in the convenience store. They see what you've taken off the shelves, and then you just walk out. I don't know if there's any other sort of identity data that they have on you when they do that. I'm just wondering if that's problematic or if that's just convenient.
Well, I mean, our constant push for convenience has created a lot of problematic implementations of technology. And, you know, that what you describe in kind of any collection of our data a lot of times is problematic in the U.S. because, again, we don't have the overarching privacy laws to provide the kind of public confidence in the collection of this data, the safeguards that are necessary. And what is problem, whether it's collecting personal information or biometrics specifically, is you don't know how long those things are going to be held. You don't know how it's going to be used in the future, right? And you kind of like lack a lot of control over that data. And this is kind of where the problems start coming up. You just don't have the control, don't know how it's going to be used. And a lot of times you don't even know how much or what information is being collected by you about you.
Jeremy D. Scott, director of EPIC's project on surveillance oversight. Thank you for joining us today. We love talking about this topic. It is super interesting. So thank you.
Thanks, Chris. Thanks, Amy. Appreciate it.
Podcasting isn't just evolving. It's having a full-blown identity crisis. I'm Allison Marino, host of What's a Podcast? The Revolution Redefined, a new series that pulls back the curtain on the forces shaping the medium now. And what that means for all of us who love podcasts. I'm really excited to share the official trailer where you'll hear from some of the biggest names in the space. Ira Glass, Leo Laporte, Guy Raz, Hernan Lopez, Lex Friedman, AJ Feliciano, Dan Granger, and yeah, me too. Here it is now.
I still want to kill the word podcast.
That's not just a hot take. It's a symptom of an identity crisis.
Big company run media, and people are trusting it less and less. It's really important that we're independent.
There's a handful of companies that control the vast majority of podcast inventory that have the vast majority of the gigantic shows.
We left radio behind for a reason. We wanted to get away from all the gatekeepers.
I don't know that you could do this as effectively in video.
Podcasting is at a crossroads. I've watched the industry swing from hype to consolidation to reinvention. But this time it's different. From the producers of the documentary Age of Audio, Oxford Road presents the Media Roundtable special series. What's a podcast? The Revolution Redefined.
All of us who work in the media, like, yeah, we got to run a business and like, we got to make a living and we got to sell our ads and we got to do all that. But we all got into it because like, I think most of us, like, it just gave us a feeling.
A three-part series where you'll hear the leading industry voices give their takes on what podcasting has become and where it's headed next. Teaming up with Oxford Road and Age of Audio director Sean Colon for this series was fun, but also kind of a wake-up call. If you love this medium as much as I do, you've got to listen to What's a Podcast? The Revolution Redefined. It's out now, wherever you get your podcasts.